Our final speaker before the break is Paul Fletcher from the University of Cambridge. I actually first met Paul when we were fellows at the same time at the Hammersmith Hospital way back in the mid-90s. Paul is a Wellcome Trust Senior Research Fellow, and he holds the Bernard Wolf Chair of Health Neuroscience at Cambridge University. He's interested in studying reward and reinforcement learning, and his main area of interest used to be and still is psychosis and schizophrenia, and he has recently used the same methodology and the same ideas to study areas related to hunger and appetite. And so we'll be very interested to hear his talk. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you very much indeed to the organisers of this conference. It's a massive undertaking, I'm sure. And my tendency is to try and rush through this so that I can hear the rest of the speakers, because it really is a fantastic programme. I am going to divide my talk into two roughly equal parts. In the first, I'm going to selectively and very non-exhaustively review some of the functional neuroimaging literature on food and food-related stimuli in human people of various descriptions, from controls to obese. All I really want to do in this part of the talk is to give you an overview of what's been done and to try and convince you that we have established some very interesting findings. There are a number of key brain regions in the mesocortical mesolimbic system that show sensitivity to these tasks and these stimuli. That sensitivity seems to relate to the nature of the stimuli, to the subjective state in which the person finds themselves. It also relates to their current state of hunger or satiety. It's also, there's a great deal of individual variability in these brain responses. For example, it's variability that can quite credibly be related to individual variability in terms of gender, genotype, circulating levels of hormones, drug challenges. And moreover, the variability that we see seems to have strong predictive value. It's predictive of and predicted by food-related behaviors, anthropomorphic variables. So I think there's an awful lot coming together in these key brain systems. A lot of the work actually done by people in this room, that gives us grounds for being optimistic about the use of these techniques in trying to understand eating and eating-related phenomena. On the other hand, I want to extend in the second part of the talk to really try and take things further, move away from reflective or descriptive models in which brain responses really reflect in many ways what we already know from the behavioural level, and try and look at developing explanatory models. And in doing this, I'll be looking at reinforcement learning in humans, and actually speaking specifically to goal-directed versus habitual behaviour. So I'm a psychiatrist. I was predominantly interested in reinforcement and reward learning in relation to the perceptions, beliefs, and experiences that accompany and characterize major mental illnesses. But I started to get very interested in these processes through discussion with Steve O'Reilly and Sadaf Farooqi at the Institute of Metabolic Science. And it was clear to me that they were equally interested in the brain as a reinforcement learning apparatus. And while my interest was quite top-down from the perspective of prior expectations, beliefs, experiences, they were very interested in bottom-up bodily signals and how that affected the reinforcement learning apparatus. And we shared a common interest, as our talks emerged, in this integration between the body and the brain, and ultimately the behaviour, which of course suits the topic of this symposium very nicely. And it was also clear to me that there were a number of studies emerging over this time using very creative and interesting ways of looking at food-related behaviour. Here's an early one from Pelshaw and others. This is looking at, I won't go into details of the studies I'm going to show you, I don't think there's time, but they manipulated the extent to which individuals experienced craving for food, and they showed, I'm assuming this is the pointer, yep, they showed midbrain and ventral striatal and insula and various other limbic and cortical regions that were sensitive to this. And this was very much in keeping with the areas that we were showing being highly sensitive to certain aspects of perception and belief in mental illness. And this was very striking to me. Scrutinizing the literature further, work from Small et al. Used a very nice design in which, over the course of a series of scans, they fed individuals increasing amounts of chocolates, turning their appetitive status into aversive status. And in these key regions, including striatum and midbrain, there was a gradual reduction across scans in the level of activity as the chocolate took its effect. Perubska, another example of study looking at food-related imagery. Here the subjects showed higher levels of activity in key insular and striatal regions when they were looking at images that they rated as being very highly subjectively appealing compared to ones that they didn't. Del Parigi, who really has been a pioneer in this area, has looked at the twin impacts of the status of hunger and satiety and gender on levels of activity in response to food-related stimuli, and shown again lots of overlap in striatal regions, but also gender differences, areas of non-overlap, and look at the impact of satiety, much reduced activity in these regions. Now, this led Asson, being quite inspired by this work, to decide to actually see if we could prove the concept by looking at the integration between bodily signals and higher level brain responses to food related stimuli. And we had a very unique, at the time, opportunity to look at individuals who had leptin deficiency. Leptin, as you'll know, is an adipocyte derived hormone which reduces in its levels with food deprivation, is thought to be very important. The reduction in leptin is thought to be a very important drive towards eating. And individuals who completely lack leptin suffer from a very severe early onset hyperphagia, which is treatable with injections of recombinant leptin. Here's the same individual before and after several years of treatment. Now, we had a couple of individuals who had recently been diagnosed with leptin deficiency, and we were able to scan them before and after the leptin treatment. We used deliberately a very simple paradigm, and I'll just run you through the main findings here. Essentially, what we found was that if you look at cumbent striatal regions in the leptin deficient state, in both subjects 1 and subject 2, the level of activity is much higher than a week after leptin treatment when they're looking at pictures of food that to them seem very compelling and attractive. So leptin seems to reduce the brain response to these highly palatable food images. Interestingly, if we relate the levels of activity in the accumbens in subject 1 and subject 2, that's yellow and red, to the amount of liking that they show for individual images that they were shown, in the leptin deficient state, whether they were fed or fasted, there is a significant relationship between the level of activity here and the amount that they like the image. Whereas when they've been treated with leptin, they actually become a little bit more discerning in that in the sated state, they no longer show that relationship, whereas they still do in the fasted state. So this is an interaction between satiety and leptin related to the degree to which accumbens codes the pleasure they receive in a stimulus. Now, we weren't alone in making these manipulations. Batterham and others manipulated the gut-derived peptide, PYY, which suppresses food intake and appetite. And what they showed was that in both hypothalamus and orbitofrontal cortex, on the day that the subjects received peptide YY, there was a strong relationship between the level of the hormone, which is in red, and the bold signal in both regions. You can just see it behind this line here, whereas that wasn't the case on the day that they received saline. Now, intriguingly, in the hypothalamus, the extent of activation that subjects showed predicted their subsequent calorie intake, but only on the day that they received saline. In the orbitofrontal cortex, conversely, the level of activity predicted how much they were going to eat, but only on the day that they received PYY. A very interesting finding here of an interaction between the two regions. I don't need to go through this study because Dr. Beguet has already done so, but essentially they used infusion of ghrelin and showed that brain regions become ghrelin, as you know, is a gastric secreted hormone, which leads to or enhances food intake. And with higher levels of circulating ghrelin, there's a lot of increased activity in insular and limbic regions, ghrelin being the blue here. And interestingly, in the orbitofrontal cortex and the amygdala, regions that code or seem to code the incentive value of food, then the level of activity seems to relate to the amount of hunger that they experience. These studies have also taken things further and have actually tried to relate the activity that's being found to the underlying neurochemistry. This is a lovely study from, actually I have to say that because two of the authors are in the room, but it genuinely is a very interesting study using PET binding, in which they use raclopride to look at dorsal striatal levels of binding pre and post, or before eating or, after eating or after not having eaten. And essentially in the dorsal striatum, the level of binding went down when they had eaten a meal, which suggests that there's more endogenous dopamine that's grabbing all of the dopamine receptors. So in other words, eating the meal has driven up the levels of dopamine. And the amount that it drives it up in left and right striatum actually relates to the degree to which they'd found the meal that they'd just eaten pleasant. Now, this has been taken further indirectly, but again very elegantly, in the context of a model, a dopaminergic model of obesity, the suggestion being that in dorsal striatum, reduced level of dopamine receptors or dopamine activity might actually lead to overeating. And what Stice and others found, and Dana Small found, was that in dorsal striatum, across two studies, the brain response to a liquid food reward was actually lower in people who had a higher body mass index. Interestingly, this is actually modified by genetics. People who have the A1 allele of the TACC1A1DRD2 gene, which actually is associated with reduced levels of dopamine receptors and enhanced increased obesity, this effect, this relationship between BMI and reduced dorsal striatal response is greater in those individuals. So it's a genotype by BMI interaction, which is fascinating, or genotype by BMI by brain interaction. We took this further looking at the impact of a serotonin challenge, and what we were interested in was treatment with what used to be a commonly prescribed anti-obesity drug, sibutramine, but which has since been taken off the market shortly after we got these results, much to our dismay. But nevertheless, I think it's giving us some interesting insights. And what we found was that if we compared, the study compared placebo versus sibutramine in a crossover design. I don't want to go into details, it's not important. We compared looking at pictures of yummy, highly palatable, high-calorie foods with not-so-pleasant ones, depending on who you are. And we looked at it in the fasted and the fed state. And we were very interested further in looking at the relationship between the brain imaging findings and what happened later that afternoon when they were given unlimited access to snacks, and also what happened to their weight over the two-week period. And to cut to the chase, what we found was that in red are all the brain regions in our regions of interest that responded to high-calorie foods compared to low-calorie foods. So precisely as we'd expected, striatal, midbrain, also amygdala, you can see here. In green are the regions that show a stimulus type, in other words, high-calorie versus low-calorie, by drug interactions. These are the regions in which, well, actually, I'm calling it hypothalamus with all due caution because it's functional imaging, so the spatial resolution is not terrific. But in hypothalamus and amygdala, the previous high response to high-calorie foods in these regions was suppressed following sibutramine. Interestingly, in ventral striatum, the same effect was produced by satiety, but not by sibutramine. So there's a high response in the fasted state, but when you've just eaten, that response goes down, which is in keeping with our leptin findings. Individual subjects, just to remind me to say that we did actually try quite carefully to check that it was hypothalamus by looking at individual results. So here's the results in the hypothalamus. Essentially, in the fasted and the fed state, for placebo, there's a high response there, and it's reduced under sibutramine, but that only pertains to high-calorie stimuli and not low. Interestingly, the magnitude of that effect of sibutramine predicted a reduction in the amount that they consumed when they were given ad lib access later in the day. So the people who were more sensitive to sibutramine in terms of their hypothalamic suppression showed a behavioral change as a result of that, and they also lost more weight. that's a bit of a rush through. What I'm trying to tell you, really, if you want to step back and defocus, is that across a nigh on a decade now, there have been lots and lots of studies of brain responses using the new neuroimaging techniques that have shown mesocortical limbic sensitivity to food and food-related stimuli. This sensitivity seems to be modulated by a number of factors that you would expect. How hungry the subject is, how palatable the stimulus is. It's modulated by levels of circulating hormones, peptides. It's modulated by drugs that you would expect to modulate it. In addition, the individual variability of gender, genotype, particular food preferences all seem to modulate that activity. And furthermore, it seems to have some status with respect to predicting things like eating behaviours and weight loss. So far, so good. But what I'd like to suggest in the last 10 minutes now is that actually we need to go much further than that. You don't need to lie somebody in a 3-Tesla scanner to be able to discover that eating makes them less hungry, or to that circulating levels of PYY will stop them from wanting to eat. I mean, the question that we must ask ourselves is what these insights, these observations of hypothalamus, of ventral dorsal striatum, what they're actually telling us about the processes that change. And through making that link between the brain response and the process, we can hopefully go on to predict behaviours and modifications of behaviours. And so I'd like to just make an appeal. It's nowhere near actually as eloquent an appeal as the previous two speakers, who have both, I think, made the same point very powerfully, that we need to think about making these observations in the context of empirically based cognitive neuroscience models. And the one I have is quite simple, really. It's this, and it's not mine. Essentially, out there we have stimuli, we have outcomes, and we have actions that we can engage in. Stimuli can predict outcomes. If you see an apple tree, it predicts the apple. Stimuli also can enhance actions, they can drive actions. If you see an apple tree, you may seek to climb. Outcomes, too, the thoughts of outcomes can drive actions. Again, the thought of the apple may make you climb the tree. Interestingly, actions themselves can actually make you think of outcomes. Climbing may make you think of the apple. There are all sorts of ways in which these things can interact. Naturally, we know that, and I'm simplifying things grossly. Of course, nowadays, it's not so much climbing apples or climbing trees to get apples, which we wouldn't be here if that was the case. It's much more, we see a stimulus, we have a very simple, non-energy demanding response, and we get quite a high calorie outcome. So this is the sort of situation we start with. And of course, it's much, much more complex than that. We know that there are many, many primes out there that will make us think of the stimuli or will drive us towards the stimuli. We know there are primes that will make us think of the outcome. Hunger will make us think of the sorts of things we want to eat. We know also that stimuli themselves can, through repeated learning, acquire the value that what previously were outcomes have. This is called conditioned reinforcement. Money is an example of that. Money doesn't have a great deal of utility in itself, but we all love getting it. It has a reward value attached to it. We know also that actually outcomes are really important in terms of their value, and that value is non-static across contexts and time. I mean, we've already heard that incredibly eloquently this morning, and I don't need to go into detail, but we know that there are many things that will turn up the gain and turn down the gain, or turn up the value and turn down the value. We know superimposed on top of that are things like memory, social context, and I'm delighted that Suzanne Higgs is here because I find her work absolutely incredible in this respect, and we'll be hearing from her later. We know that the value can actually impact upon the way that an outcome drives an action, and also ultimately the value can establish strong stimulus action associations that ultimately can lead to habitual type behaviours. This is known for as long as back as Thorndike's early work, and he called it the law of effect. If you do something, if you see something and do something, and what you get as a result of that is good, then the next time you see that something, you'll do that same something. Now, of course, as I said, this is incredibly complex, but I still think that there's some grounds for actually looking for simple patterns within it. And the work of Belain and Dickinson and Sona DeWitt and others has suggested that actually we've got two broad ways of behaving within our environment. Now, this dichotomy does not really, I think it's orthogonal to the one that we've already heard about in terms of deliberative versus effective decision making. Well, maybe not orthogonal to it, but it's, I may be mistaken, maybe we could discuss it, but I think the deliberative versus effective decision making really pertains almost entirely to goal-directed behaviour, whereas I think there's another form of behaviour we need to think about as well, which is habitual behaviour. Now, goal-directed behaviour essentially means that you perform the action to get the outcome. It's driven by belief and desire. Ooh, just had a buzz. The buzz means keep talking as long as you can. Yeah. I've only got a couple of minutes. Driven by belief and desire, the belief that if you perform that action, you will get the outcome, and the desire for that outcome. So it's as most of us would think we behave in the world. Habitual behaviours, on the other hand, are automatic. The stimulus occurs, we perform the action, irrespective of the outcome. Now, goal-directed behaviour is quickly established. It's slower responding because it involves thinking about the outcome. It's sensitive to outcome value, critically. You don't do it if you don't want the outcome that you're thinking about. Distinctly, habitual behaviour is not sensitive to outcome value. It's inflexible and hard to modify. And even if you no longer like or want the outcome, you may still engage in it, which can, of course, be problematic. And this has been an important model of drug addictive behaviours. So the question is, given that these are not really independent systems, they are descriptively different, but the likelihood is that they are highly integrated and one piggybacks upon the other, depending on the context, depending on many factors. How can we actually try and distinguish these in the context of neuroimaging in a way that allows us to pull out the neural responses to one versus the other, and then to use that information at a later date to try and understand phenotypes, let's say in obesity? Well, let's imagine that we have a stimulus that predicts a particular outcome if you make a particular response. Let's say you see an apple, you press right, you get cherries, just as an example. Now, that can be achieved either through habit stimulus response outcome. In other words, see the apple, if you press right, you're going to get what you want, but you don't need to think about what you want. Or see the apple, think of cherries, and that reminds you of the response. Now, how can we actually alter the balance in one direction or the other? Well, what Sona DeWitt thought of, which I think is a very clever idea, is actually across different trials, you make the outcome of one particular trial the stimulus for another. So in this case, you see the cherries. If and only if you press left, you then get the apple. Now, if you try and solve this problem through outcome-based responding, you are going to be in trouble because you see the cherries. You think of the apple. Now, the apple predicts the right response, but you actually have to press the left to get it. So there's a conflict that's engaged that means that performing it according to this particular approach is less useful and less efficient. So this, and Sona has shown this through a number of studies, that actually people tend to favour the balance towards habitual responding here. When they're performing this task. And so we entered this into the scanner. We showed, I don't want to go into this in detail, but in the conflict condition here, subjects are slower to learn and they're also slower to perform because the habitual system is gradually taking over. If you use a devaluation task, you show that they are not able to devalue the response. In other words, their performance is reduced when you have to devalue, suggesting that they're not performing according to goal-directed responding. What we find is that as somebody moves from goal-directed to habitual responding, there is a reduction in activity in ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And interestingly, the people who reduce that the most tend to do worse on the goal-directed task that they perform later, the devaluation task. So this is some evidence in favour of the possibility that moving from goal-directed to habitual responding is associated with a reduction in ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Now, another approach that I'll just tell you about briefly in the last 30 seconds is to use Pavlovian instrumental transfer. This is another way of pulling apart those two systems. Suppose you see a particular symbol. If you press the right key, you get a particular outcome. That's instrumental responding. You do it to get it. If you're learn that, and you're then shown that stimulus in extinction and asked, what would you press? Well, you tend to press right. You might do it because you're thinking of the chocolate, you might do it because you're responding habitually. We really don't know. But there is a way of finding out, or of actually fostering outcome-based responding, using another stimulus. This one, let's say a blue triangle, also predicts the same outcome, but in this case, you don't have to do anything. It's purely Pavlovian. Now here, if you show them that stimulus and say, okay, press one of those keys, whichever feels right, doesn't matter. Now they tend to press the right key, the one that was previously associated with gaining that. And that's Pavlovian instrumental transfer. But they can't have done it habitually. There's no way, because this was never associated with a response. They must have brought to mind the outcome. So if we can induce goal-directed responding, or if we can induce Pavlovian instrumental transfer, we have a series of stimuli that can only produce the outcome via goal-directed responding. And when we do that, we see bilateral ventral striatal activation in association with goal-directed responding. Now, I'm aware that I've gone on for my half an hour, or nearly my half an hour. So I'll just sum up now. This is work that has been carried out in discussion with some very good experimental psychologists and endocrinologists. Its purpose has been essentially, well, it's preliminary, as you'll see. The purpose has been to try and build upon what I consider to be a very elegant and growing body of literature linking neural responses to high-level behaviours that ultimately may result in health-harming behaviour. I think the challenge for us is to try and link the neural to the behavioural in a way that makes sense at the cognitive level. And that's what I've been trying to put forward today. I'm sure we'll hear much more about that later today, so I shall step back and enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions?
Raymond?
Thank you.
First of all, the quick question: did you see cardiac response in the virtual task, the 2009 paper? Because that's in other studies without doing, you tend to see cardiac increasing in the visual behavior.
Yeah, so for those who didn't hear at the back, the question is, does the dorsal striatum or caudate show a response to habitual behaviour? No, we didn't see that, and we were surprised by that, I must say.
Okay, let me ask the second part of the question then. I'm just wondering, given the direction that you're going, what you think about the model of Robbins and Everett, that addiction or compulsive behaviour is corresponds to movement from ventral striatal control over activity to dorsal striatal control over activity. Do you think we can apply that to food?
Well, I think if we're talking about moving from goal-directed to habitual responding, then I think that might be a part of it, and there may be subgroups of individuals in which the responding is habitual, in which that model might be pertinent. There are some problems I have with it. One is that I have yet to convince myself that you can just think of overeating as habitual. To me, it seems very often very goal-directed, highly hedonically satisfying, and sensitive to outcome devaluation as well. I'd also I think it'd be difficult, so I would have some caution in simply moving the addictive model in terms of ventral to dorsal striatum onto the hyperphagia model. I also, and I'd hope to speak to you about this today, was I have some problems in understanding how that would relate to the model that you and Eric Stice and others have put forward about hypodopaminergic function in dorsal striatum as a drive towards obesity. I mean, I think your data are compellingly in favour of that. People with high BMI show reduced dorsal striatal responses.
But if that turns out to be a consequence of overeating as opposed to a cause.
Right, so the starting point actually would be more habitual behaviour manifest in dorsal striatal responding, leading ultimately to a suppressed sensitivity of dorsal striatum. Yeah, so I'm sorry, I'm satisfying my own curiosity here rather than answering your question. And you know, I am fascinated by it. The short answer is I think it's a possibility that translation from goal-directed ventral to dorsolateral habitual may play a part. But as we've heard, you know, obesity is an incredibly complex phenotype and it may only pertain to a group of individuals.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I always ask the question, knowing more of the brain needs to help us do better than we are doing now. What is it that your result would suggest in terms of behavioral intervention, policy, and innovation?
I think that is a very good question. I mean, I think one thing that we need to do, this actually relates very strongly to my other life, which is trying to understand schizophrenia. In schizophrenia, a profound problem that we have is it's a constellation of probably different illnesses, which have the same broad phenotype, but actually when you drill down, there are lots of sub-phenotypes. I think understanding phenotypes in terms of precise brain responses, which in themselves tell us more about precise cognitive responses, might help us to separate out the groups, and in doing so to actually tailor management treatment in ways that are suitable for those groups. Another way of looking at it is by, for example, in the sibutramine study, we have a marker there for a drug, admittedly a drug that can no longer be given to people because of cardiovascular risk, but we have a marker, even at the early stages of treatment, for how well it's going to impact upon somebody's eating behaviour and upon their subsequent weight loss. Now, this is quite an exciting possibility because it suggests a setting in which to test other new compounds, which is what we're doing in collaboration with GSK, but also to try and tailor treatments to people who have particular profiles of neural response to food stuff. So I think there are lots of vague possibilities. I think, you know, one of the reasons we're all gathering here today, actually, is to discuss those in more detail.
Just coming back to this issue of the possible links between drug addiction and loss of control of feeding behavior, feeding for obesity, I was really intrigued by the slide you presented showing a decrease in dopamine receptors being associated, at least I saw it that way, associated with an increase in feeding behavior or tendency to obesity. Because that does make a link to the drug addiction literature. You may
yes.
be aware of Nora Volkoff's
yep.
studies, really beautiful and indisputable evidence of a reduction in D2 receptors being associated with very serious cocaine addiction. Yeah, this one.
Oh, sorry. Actually, the receptor one was this one. Sorry. Yes. So this, the receptors were related to eating. So,
yeah.
Let me just. No, sorry. This is the one you want, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
yeah. Okay.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So now we have a link, at least on this neurobiological metric,
mm-hmm.
for something that's linking drug addiction. I mean, cocaine addiction in the Volkoff state.
Yeah.
And in Spice's paper here, overeating. So.
Yeah, I think that's great because it also shows you a group of individuals with high BMI who are not showing that, who don't have the A1 allele. So, you know, already you're separating them out into two populations. So maybe Dana would comment since she was the senior author on this.
Your response in the caudate decreases. And we think that's probably related to a neural adaptation to overeating, which may be greater in A1. And if you actually look at lean kids who are either have two parents that are obese or two parents that are lean, you would predict if the caudate response was a risk factor for overeating, you would expect higher caudate, lower caudate, but in fact you see higher caudate. So I guess the whole story comes together, which may be similar to drug addiction, is that you have this incredibly dynamic relationship whereby if you have a gene, you are perhaps more vulnerable to environmental impact that could increase your risk for, you know, further overeating or whatever. And I think it really exists to Nora's work for some segment of the population.
There's another study, Kenny and Johnson, very interesting, where they used a viral vector to downregulate D2 receptors in animals, and that triggered compulsive overeating. So downregulating the D2 system actually makes the animal overeat, as do drugs that block.
As opposed to co-operative.
As do drugs like neuroleptics.
But that was only if the animals had access to the high fat food,
right.
Which implied importance of the interaction with the diet.
If I could just say something about the striatal signal. There's tremendous amount of evidence that the striatal signal in a whole bunch of experiments is a reward prediction error signal. That is, it's a signal that computes the difference between expected reward and received reward. And so you can explain the obesity findings by suggesting that they have a higher anticipation. So their reward anticipation is higher, therefore when they get the milkshake, they have less of a response. Now, that's testable, but that, in my opinion, is the most likely interpretation of that finding.
And that would pertain to ventral striatum?
Well, I think dorsal or ventral could both show that. Angelo?
Yeah, Paul, very interesting, as always. I would like to say with you to think maybe provocatively about the opportunity, and I guess this ties very well with the general scope of this meeting, to push the agenda and bring to society that goes through many things, including discovering new drugs for obesity. If pay more attention to neurochemistry, maybe functional neurochemistry, receptor systems, neurotransmitter systems, might be more productive than doing market. And I say this because, of course, I mean, there is quite a bit of frustration to feel about what nothing exercise is able to do. Also because the univocal relationship between RSO-based responses, of course, in terms of meaning, is including science and stimulus, competences, and so on. Not that the neurochemistry is univocal, but at least I think it would provide a shortcut to discovery of new drugs and maybe to validation of drugs. I think your work on sabutamol is very good. I was trying to do something similar with other drugs because it's really a good way to test how certain drugs that have produced effects actually might manipulate the neurochemistry of the brain and so possibly generate biomarkers for the efficacy of new drugs.
Sure.
If I've understood you correctly, and for those who didn't hear, that the provocative comment was, well, we could leave, I mean, I'll summarise it and make it extra provocative, is that let's leave this mapping nonsense behind, let's look at the neurochemistry, that's where the real deal is, and manipulate neurochemistry with drugs or use receptor ligands and measure that in context of behaviours. Would that be a reasonably or not too unfair representation of your provocative comment? Okay. That's terribly mean. I didn't come here to be insulted, you know. I, to an extent, I do think that the receptor work has to be important in all of this. However, I cannot think of the brain without thinking of it as a cognitive machine. And I think if we're going to relate the brain ultimately to the behaviours, then we do need to go via the mechanism of cognitive computational neuroscience, because without that, we essentially have an explanatory gap. I mean, I'm very mindful of this in schizophrenia, where somebody tries to tell me that too much dopamine makes you think your neighbours are trying to kill you. On one level, that's an explanation, but the patients seem never too pleased with that as an explanation, because actually it's missing out a whole level of description that ultimately might be very important and very useful. So while I agree with your point about emphasising the neurochemistry and the structure and the drug challenges, I don't think we can or should leave cognition behind as part of the whole enterprise. I've finished. Yeah, okay. I'll be avoiding you all day.
So we're going to have a break. There's coffee and muffins. I just want to point out that the muffin consumption is being monitored. So we're going to compare, you know, in this kind of conference relative to other medical conferences.